Now, to return, let's get into more of the nuts and bolts of actual things here. It's like a circus. So one of the things that this has, that comes with it, is a DVD-ROM that for six different songs has, let's pull this up, has the actual plugins that were used. It has the 24-bit pre-master, the 16-bit master. Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's a good idea. Sounds great. Thank you. Appreciate it. So, perfect. So here's the first stage of the desktop mastering chain. And one of the things that's important about this, I'm going to extemporaneize a little bit, is this guy here is really critical. It's a high-pass filter at 20 hertz. And what that does for us, for me, is it gets rid of DC offset. DC offset is,
rumble filter.
Well, it's even lower than that. What let's do, let's look at a waveform here. And the blue line, often in a classroom situation, I'd say, what does the blue line represent? Yeah, I guess I will say that. Actually, what does the blue line represent?
Zero crossing.
Okay, well, that's where the green line crosses the blue line. But the blue line itself is?
DC.
Pardon me?
DC. Zero.
DC. Okay. It's the speaker at rest. It's air pressure in the room. Okay? So if the green line goes along the blue line, the speaker is at rest. When the green line goes above the blue line, what happens?
Speaker code goes
the speaker moves out.
That would be the best.
Exactly. Oh, did something happen? Okay. And when the green line goes below the blue line, the speaker moves back, right? So what we're actually seeing is an analog of the speaker's motion across the speaker at rest as it's moving, which is pretty cool. And high frequencies travel on the low frequencies there. Now, DC offset, and there you can see some sibilance right here. This is high frequencies. Get into it one moment. There it is. Yeah, so that's probably an S of some form. I don't know if our audio is... Okay, that's fine. So what DC offset is when the entire file is above or below zero, which means that the waveform, instead of going through the speaker at rest, is actually slightly off one side or another. And we feel this directly when we go up in elevators, and our ears get plugged because the pressure imbalance is happening. And that's the way your speakers feel when they have DC offset. Let's see if I can get into this brain. This is my brain. You probably haven't seen things outside of people's heads that are DC offset. So this is the way I write the book, actually. And that is after. Here we go. And this is before. Okay, there's an example of DC offset that really came in. And it was really wild. And DC is 0 hertz, which means it does not cross the middle line. And 0 hertz is less than 20 hertz. Therefore, a low-cut or high-pass filter at 20 hertz gives you a result of this. It's pretty fascinating how it zeroes it all up. What I used to do with DC offset was take the statistics, this is a newer version, the statistics of the file, and it would say like plus 9 or minus 27 or whatever, and I'd go into the DC offset tool and type in the complement to it. So if it's minus 27, I put in 27. But as you saw in that one piece, not all DC offset is created equal. And so whenever you'd go plus, that was really confusing. So what was great is right at the very beginning, you get it comfortable as DC offset.
Why not lower frequency?
Pardon me?
Why not even lower frequency, so you don't mess with any fade? phases less?
Well.
Like 5 hertz or 8 hertz?
I don't know how far down I can go with this particular plugin, first of all. And I think that 20 hertz, I'm not minding losing things at 20 hertz and below. Because these things, it's more barometric air changes in the room as compared to actual audio. And then this is also where if we've got too much stuff happening down in the bass, we can either boost, or not enough, we can boost or cut here. And also if someone gives me something that's really slamming, I can pull down the level completely. Your question or?
How many order filter is your high pass?
You'll have to look at the Waves documentation.
It's a linear phase filter, so it's just a time delay.
Yay, thank you, Ray. Ray is the designer of the constant Q, no, the perfect Q DSP algorithm, has a Olds patent for that, for Rain's piece, which is what I use actually to flatten my speakers.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah, so anyway, this is the first stage. Then we go into the noise reduction, which has two pages to it. And it has different reduction types. This one is the more broadband area and method, and the other methods that are here more hit the higher frequencies. And I always have these things set this way. With no, what they'll give you, oftentimes plugins will give you things that are not good for you, like the high shelf start, so it gets rid of, supposedly gets rid of high frequencies and then it'll push it back up. But we don't want that at all in this case. So what we do is we go and look at this, and this is a typical noise print for this particular song, actually. You'll see the low end here, this excursion up here, which was the noise print. And I go in and zoom in and pull these guys down. And it's got 1024, that's right, 1024 noise gates, each one of these are little squares across the frequency range. And then the stereo enhancer, stereo imager here, which this is really, really subtle. The entire range that I will use this plugin in is between 1.00 and 1.04. It's just really sort of, I've been slapped for this, but it really uplifts and separates is what it gives a little bit more air into the piece. It also helps you if you need to flip phase. It has phase control, lets you go to MS processing as required, and there's been a couple of times that I've needed to do that. It lets, MS is mid-side, so it's the mono components and the stereo components are separated out. And it also has, if you click this out button, it will give you a mid-size side view of the meters. So your mono components are on this side and your stereo components are here, which lets you see if it's out of phase. So for instance, if mono is really small and stereo is high, it's probably out of phase. And lets you see how much you've got of this. But this again is a preparation, you know, piece. So this is the C4, which is the most critical aspect in these bands. This is not a preset that comes with the piece. This is something that I pretty much, I call it the fish shape, and they're all slightly different. And you've got the low end. You've got what we call the TV speaker sound, but these days, because TVs sound so good, we've got to say maybe notebook speaker sound, but it's sort of dull and muffled in this range. And then the articulation range here, and then the top octave from 10K to 20K is here, and that's just the highest sizzly bits. This is where we take gain, and these days I've been taking a lot. What's interesting is depending on how loud the original mix pre-master is, and what it is. If it's just a singer-songwriter with a guitar, we're not going to peg these, you know. But for rock, this, I'm taking gain back up so that these guys go to pretty much full deflection. And what we have here is the gain, which is the top area here, and the range, which is how much it's allowed to deflect. And this yellow line here, and I'll show you a video that shows this in process, is the instantaneous EQ curve. So when the signal in each of these ranges, these are meters for each of those ranges, when the signal is below where the threshold is set, then it's going to be up above the middle, basically, of this range. And since I've got it symmetric here, when the meter is right at the threshold, it's going to be sort of unity gain, right in the middle. So if it goes above this threshold indicator, then it starts compressing down. So when it's below, it's actually expanding in this area. When it gets to this point, which is where I try and set it for most of the time, it's going to stay right about there, so that there's not a lot of changes happening. And one thing that's interesting about this, when it's set correctly, because this works with the de-esser pretty much, so you set the de-esser, which is not in this particular chain, to handle the harshest hits of high frequency going through, and once that becomes calmed down, then this becomes the true de-esser or enhancer of those frequency ranges. And when it's set right, these look sort of like lips here. And this thing, when it's set right, it will sing to you. It opens its mouth more as it sort of, ah, wow, wow. You know, it's very fascinating to watch. And that's one of the joyful, this is the greatest video game that you could imagine. You know, this and circuit board designs, similar things. And then, so this upper mid-range thing, we sort of clamp it. And the top octave, we sort of clamp it so it doesn't really have a lot of motion. So then we go in to the ultra maximizer, which typically has a 4.5 threshold down. So you pull this down, it gets louder. I never go beyond like 4.9, and I often go much higher than this, depending on what we're working with. It's got quantizer, dither, and noise shaping, and I go into reasonable amounts of information on here. There's actually a QR code that goes to this DSP textbook that goes into hella detail about this. That's where I learned all my stuff. So basically all the QR codes, if I learn something from somewhere else, I just pop you there. So why should I have to duplicate where I learned it? And there's some excellent resources outside the book. This is more like a hypertext in the Ted Nelson original Xanadu concept, which is not just that movie. So then, look, it went through. That's fascinating. I don't actually have the PAS analyzer, which is what is normally going to be next in the chain, because that shows you where stuff is and how the stereo field is working. So what this is a picture of the pre-master. This is a wonderful level and vision for a pre-master. It's 24-bit, and down here there's this thing that I put a start noise in, and I'm going to describe that in just a moment. Let's see, what else do we... There, then that's the mastered piece. When you're zoomed out, this may look sort of log-like, but when you're zoomed out this far, if you go in, nothing is clipping, and everything is... most of this is just the main transient issues. Dynamic range, which is the difference between the loudest and the softest sounds in a file, I sort of have a different definition of it. I feel it's the softest sounds you can hear during the loudest parts, so as compared to just it's loud here and it's soft over here, is that if it's overly compressed, then everything's about the same level, and they're all, you can hear it, but the soft things, but they're loud. But if you can hear the soft things still being soft in the background, then I feel it has good dynamic range. So this is an August company we have here. Does anyone have any agreements or disagreements with that, with dynamic range described in that way?
That's not really the textbook definition, but it's a useful
fiction. What would the textbook definition be?
The ratio between the largest signal you can have and the noise floor.
Okay. Okay, sweet. So again, this my work is based on useful fictions. And so I should have said that at the beginning of the book. I'll say it at the beginning of the next book.
I have a question for you.
Yes.
So you were saying that's your optimal wave file.
Pre-master.
Where is it peaking at, like minus 12 or so?
No, it's well, this is minus 6 here, the lines. So I like 2 to 3 dB down.
Yeah. Okay, so you're not trying to, you don't want to compromise bit depth by having like something peaking at minus 18 or minus 12.
The most important thing that I can talk about is bit depth, and it's just really quite excellent. So here, bit depth, I'm going to read it. I really believe in 24-bit files coming in. So, as a mastering engineer, my 16-bit masters sound significantly superior to the 24-bit mixes I begin with, but it's important for me to start with the 24-bit files. Digital audio has time resolution measured in samples and amplitude resolution determined by bit depth. I highly prefer better amplitude resolution than higher sample rates. This is one of the things that when you're out of the box, you want as high a sample rate and bit depth as you can in order to present that to the out-of-the-box things. But in the box, since you're going to end up at 44.1, 44.1 is fine. It satisfies Nyquist, and we're happy. Well, I should have just kept reading. First of all, according to the Nyquist theorem, the frequency band from 20 to 20 kilohertz is amply served by a 44.1 kilohertz sample rate. The only thing higher sample rates provide for are gentler sloping low-pass anti-aliasing filters above 20 kilohertz. However, an increase in bit depth gives a measurable increase in quality and accuracy. If I receive a 16-bit pre-master file, each sample has 65,536 different potential values, split in half, 32,768 for the positive waveform and 32,768 for the negative waveform. On the other hand, 24-bit files provide 16,777,216 values, 8.3 million for the top and for the negative. When an analog to digital converter does its work, a voltage is converted into a digital word. Higher accuracy in the conversion produces less quantization distortion. I tell my clients the following story as an illustration of the comparison between 16 and 24-bit files. The distance between Seattle and Austin is 1,769 miles. Measured in 16-bit increments, that is one mark every 142 feet for a total of 65,536 total increments at 96 dB dynamic range. Measured in 24-bit increments, there is a mark every 6 inches, which is 16,777 increments, 144 dB dynamic range. So let's think up a little helper to get a handle on the idea of digital conversion. Let's call him the quantization genie. It's his job to ultimately determine what numerical value to give to an analog measurement. When the quantization genie sees the voltage fall from the sky, he has to line it up with the nearest mark. With 16-bit, he has to run one way or the other up to 142 feet. With 24-bit, the voltage is calibrated within the nearest 6 inches. No running required, he can just drop it at his feet. Looked at another way, a full-volume 16-bit file is equivalent to a 16 times softer 24-bit file. So when I get pre-master files, I request 24-bit files with peaks that are 2 to 3 dB down from full scale. This provides what appears to be a quiet file, but with 10 times more resolution than a max 16-bit file. One of the last processors in the desktop mastering chain is a quantizer, a tool that selectively takes those 24-bit 6-inch increments and runs them out to the 16-bit 142-foot marks. It works with a rule base called dither, which keeps the quantizer from going in the same direction too often. The mastering chain and its settings determine the amount of signal manipulation and compression that a mastered file has, but a 24-bit audio pre-master source file always provides more resolution to work with. I don't know if that addressed that.
The main question was, I guess, you know, like, why not take it and use all of the numbers that you have available to you? Why leave?
Okay, because, wow. For me, in mastering, you have to turn things up as well as turn things down. And if it's all the way to the top, there's no place to turn things up. And sometimes if you're turning things down, if you're turning down a frequency that is inhibiting another frequency, let's say, is phase related to it, that can actually turn things up again. So I want to have as much headroom to be able to work with as possible. And like there's a, I've got a picture in here of a 24-bit file down 48 dB, which is what a 16-bit file Foley Max looks like. And it's basically along the middle of the line. You know, there's nothing there. So no matter what, even if it's soft, you know, I much prefer this as compared to something that's logged out as a pre-master.
So even if they're mixed down at 16 bits, you want the person that's giving the part of your customer to give you to convert that, save it to, so it's going to be 48 or
24 bit. So here's the thing, is that if it's already 16 bit as a two track, you don't want to just turn it to 24 bit because that just pads it with zeros. But if you've recorded everything at 16 bit, you can mix down to 24 bit. And then you get that additional resolution, vertical resolution, that's really so critical.
What about 32 point or floating point?
That's more. More is
it over?
It's fine. It doesn't hurt. You know, I don't, but it's not something that's, I don't think it has the a huge amount of benefit. I get them. And I get 88 twos as well, which I prefer to 96 and et cetera. But because my plug-in chain has its quantizer at the end and has it all in one, when I end up, I have to end up with a 44.1 file. So I will do, if they don't do it, I'll do the sample rate conversion down to 44.1 to start before I begin.
Why can't you just put all the stuff at the end of your mixdown chain?
You can. But one thing about mastering is that if you've mixed it for hours and hours and hours and hours, if you make a mistake, then you're going to overlook a mistake. And having a fresh, you have to trust your mastering engineer and you know, make sure that what they give you back is something that the client likes. Because the best mixing engineers, looking at you, Christian, don't really like the results of some mastering. But the end result, the clients seem to really love it. And that's sort of the important thing. It's important, actually, that the mixing engineers, in a way, don't love what a mastered file sounds like. Because what makes them good mixing engineers is their ears are tuned to get these balances right. The soft balance, I think this is a good time to actually go into a true example of this piece, which we can play. This is one of our tracks. The thing, I'll play you the pre-master and then the master, or at least parts of it. Where is, did it go away? It didn't go away. There you go, right there. Our very first song that we did together. Christian had been, that's not it. We want Fill the Ocean pre-master. There it is. That's it. So Christian had been a mixer guy at Teatro Zanzani for like 5 years and really knew what he was doing. And he wanted to become a producer. But he didn't have a lot of portfolio. I said, well, you know, I never get a chance to go downstairs and just bang out on the piano because the right and left brain type of thing, I can't really record myself conveniently, so come and please record me, and we'll just play with this. And the results exceeded expectations quite a lot. Yes?
When you do you're going to play one and then the other, right?
Yeah.
When you do that, the mastered version is going to sound louder. Are you going to adjust the overall loudness?
No, I want to trick you. I can, and what I've been finding out too, just even recently, is that I pretty much the last job that I just had a couple days ago, when I turn it down halfway on my output, it sounds the same level as what I got in as the mix. It just sounds a lot clearer and.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Right. Yeah,
just hearing it louder is not.
We can. But like for me, I sort of I like listening to things mastered, and sometimes I can't even listen to the pre-master for very long without wanting to slap my chain on it, because, you know, sort of arrogant that way. There's a thing that I also want to go into that's, don't want to go too late. That noise right there, that has become sort of a lifesaver. I had this issue with the C4 that it has a feature anomaly on it that, here, we'll play this. See that? Did you see that, those drooping pieces? When you go into soft, when you take soft thing into this, it droops until the thresholds are crossed. And I had this opportunity to do like 3,000 tracks for a licensing music library. And they sent me one song to work with, and the first song had a very slow attack. And that happened. And it went pop, right in the middle. I go, well, what the hell? You know, it was very, very irritating. So I call Waves, and they go, I don't know. And so the way I fixed that was I basically reversed some of the audio beforehand so it would actually break across and hit. That evolved into the start noise, which is like 2 seconds of semi-pink noise centered around 1K. That's always at the same level that I put in at the beginning of every single drop. And what that does for me is that not only does it bounce the saggy C4 out and get all of the thresholds passed, is I can hear exactly what the entire desktop mastering chain is doing within 2 seconds. If I pull up a different preset or whatever, is it louder, is it softer, is it brighter, is it dimmer, is it boomier, whatever. I know exactly what's happening with that. So that's extremely useful. So if we start with the start noise here, let me show you. So this each song has a video that has on this side the pre-master, and on this side the mastered version. I shot my screen with a camera, so all of this has been compiled together by my brother in Minneapolis, Dave, and I'm infinitely grateful to him. And what comes up here too is an RTA is going to come up here. And this shows what the ballistics and vectors of the C4 looks like. So I'm going to start with this so that we can set that up. One moment. There we go.
Fill the ocean.
Who's on the volume? There we go. It pops up. Should be fine, I think. And then, and this was the first song we did together. See how soft that is? Interesting that you may have heard a little bit of drums in the background in between. This is working with Christian actually taught me about demo-itis. When you listen to something over and over again and you fall in love with it, then I want to hear that some more. I really like those little drums in the background because the second mix that he sent me took them out. So is this reasonably clear what's happening here with this yellow line being, you know, the instantaneous EQ, and it's all been prepared by stuff beforehand, and it's going through the Ultra Maximizer afterwards. And by watching this, you get a pretty good idea of where frequency ranges are as students or learners of this. So, comments,
Steve,
questions?
Can you play before and after on that?
Yeah, I'm going to do that now. I only have the after on this soundtrack. So, but I wanted to show you the start noise and et cetera. So now, the pre-master. The mastered version of that. Here, we'll go back out to 16. I really like seeing the file going by at like that resolution. It taught me a lot about frequency ranges, actually. Questions, comments, impressions?
Good job.
Oh, thank you. And that's the other thing that's really wild about this, is that this is also my first music release. You're buying the CD and getting a book for free. And it's going to be very interesting to see all the different kinds of reviews that might come in. Pardon?
How long ago did you do this one?
These are within the last 4 years or so, 3 to 4 years.
You probably don't have any recollection about how long it took you to set, from first hearing the song, how much time you spent setting up the tools.
How do you mean? In mastering? To set up the mastering tools?
These particular ones here for this particular song.
Right. Well, one of the nice things is that I've got the general chain is set up. And so it's a matter of tuning, and it's like a single tool with 30 or 40 controls. And the single tool of the entire thing, I can go through and find out what I want to do pretty fast. I can dial something in 20, it depends on how much work it needs. But my Christian's work is pretty fast. 15, 20. Well, it's the length of the song. You've got to go through the whole song at least once. And then maybe two or three times. So Rick, how many times do you go through a trick? I'd like to hear the answer to that for you. What's your time frames in your asterisk.
It speeds up through the day.
From the same client?
Once you've got your handle on what's going on a given project, first tune can be an hour.
Yeah.
By the time you get to the last one, you may be doing one every 15 minutes.
Yes.
Depends on the project, how much there is to figure out, and how much help it needs.
And that's one of the things, too, about these compilation albums, is because they're coming, you have to make all of these songs that are coming from all these different studios, all these different levels, to sound like it's one record. And that's why it's such good.
The numbers go way up. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right, and the other thing, too, is that, I don't know if you sequence in the same tools that you're using to master in. Like, some people just have one tool. When I'm mastering, I have my levels set at a very specific level always. I have a very, very explicit level that I'm listening to things at, so I know how loud they are, essentially. And so I master to my taste, and when we get to sequencing, they're all the same level because I've listened to them all at the same level at my taste. So that keeps everything pretty much in sync for that. Yeah?
Do you ever have any trouble stopping or knowing when you're done? I mean, you keep listening to it, you're going to hear more stuff?
As soon as you're not pissed off, then you're done. As soon as you're not angry at something, you know, you go, man, you know, that's just not right.
Psychologically, I imagine you take a break and come back to it.
Not really. The other thing, too, is that the different kinds of songs, some songs are extremely different within themselves. Some are consistent throughout, but some have sections. And since I'm doing frequency domain and not time domain, my plugin chain has to be equivalent across. I maybe two or three times have I had to give up and actually master two different settings for a given song. Usually if something starts off, I had one of these, something that starts off really, really quiet, that gets louder and louder and louder and louder until it's completely slammed in the pre-master. It works out pretty well. Question?
Is there a difference between ways of producing a CD? Do they press some of them as opposed to laser burning them?
Well, there's replication, there's glass masters, there's, you know, duplication. Those types of things, that doesn't matter so much to me personally because I give a production master CD out. I don't do the tapes or whatever. So where it goes to, I don't know if that aims to your question.
Sort of. Is there also a speed when you're putting out a master that you don't want to do it over a certain 1x or 4x?
Oh, as far as burning?
Yeah.
Well, for me, I try like 6. These days, everything's sort of commoditized. In the earlier days when you had a lot of variability of quality, I think it was a lot more concerning than these days of the capabilities of just, I don't have Plextor drives anymore. Do you, any of the other, now you do you really, you do the HD tracks, don't you?
Yeah.
Anyone familiar with HD tracks website? I buy a lot of things from that. I love your work and it's very interesting. So Bruce does this high end stuff. HD tracks, you get 9624, you get really high bitrate stuff that you can download. And that does make a difference. But one thing that I did find out is that no matter how high the bitrate, if the original is distorted or clipped, you got distortion and clipping that you can't, which is replicated very, very well.
That's right.
So it's very cool to have your. So there are, somebody asked earlier, does the CD have future? Well, I think that for the discerning people like Gautier, new band that's getting really a lot of, I'm loving it. He, off of his website, offers a 24-bit download you can buy. And I was very happy about that. So I think that it's going to probably bifurcate it, where people that go to a higher quality sound are going to go to higher quality sound and look at off CD in that direction. And people that go to horrible MP3s are going to get off CD in that direction. So I think that's where, in the middle ground. We'll still have all the CDs that have ever been pressed. I don't think they're all going to end up in the landfill. So, and people will find things. Yeah.
Well, have you standardized on a burning speed you like? Did I miss that word?
Well, now we're getting into the sequencing and production master CD stuff. I've had issues with my hardware sometimes because I burn CD text using CD Architect onto the disk, and my mastering station, the CD drive burner, failed to write CD text. Now something went wrong, so I'm now calling the files over into another computer and rendering an image and burning to that drive across my network, basically rendering a local image and burning to that. And typically it's like 16x. So it, as compared to max, this is probably a 56x box if you put it on max, because it goes max and then like 48 and 32 and all these. So I don't find that as big of a problem, and I might be fooling myself. Rick, again, because I want to ask the people, do you have any specific burning problems?
Well, we're having a harder and harder time getting CDR-based Redbook Masters to pass muster at the factory. And it's a disk problem. It's not a burner problem. The disks are being optimized for data. Hmm. It's a commodity. We go through, on any given master, we may go through two or three to get a master to test to the level we want to test it.
Are you talking about the
We're
media?
Testing to a very high
yeah.
standard. We're doing the normal Plex tools routine, but we're also running Clover.
Right.
And nothing goes out unless it's an A, which puts it in the top 5% of acceptable disks for manufacturing.
Right.
Using like a specific brand. 6 years ago, that was not a problem.
Right, okay, yeah, because
was an A.
I've been using Disk Makers Ultra disks, which are probably Tayo or whatever. Tayo Uden, I think, is what they come from. And I had bought a CD duplicator, DVD duplicator tower from Disk Makers, and they had like a deal on it that if it's broken, so it only can use Ultra Media, is like a couple hundred dollars less. And so I did that, and since I'm always using it anyway, and there's a Hydro Shield disk surface that you can print on, and it's very, very pretty. And so that's almost as, in all the ones that I've done, I've only had the replication plant get in touch with me once that there was a problem, and everything seems to work fine all the way through so far. So I'm no longer as worried about that as I used to be, even though I probably should be. But,
You're talking CDRs or pressed?
CDRs that I give to the manufacturer, yeah. My production master CDs.
Do you upload tracks at all?
Occasionally I have been. Like Disc Makers, they have a place. I had to get ISO Buster, was it? Something that makes a BinQ set of files, which is binary, and then the Q sheet, and that goes up, and they build it. That works fine.
Does CD Architect not do DDP?
Nope. But you have a thing, right? You have a branded DDP reader, and describe what's DDP for us.
What's that?
Describe DDP, please.
Disk Description Protocol.
Right, and.
It's used a lot for DVD at higher levels, but for CDs, I think it's up to like 2.01. I think is the spec. It's a collection of files that describes the data set on an audio CD or an audio CD.
Right, right.
So it's a big DAT file plus four or five descriptors. And what we have is the Sonorous DDP player. There's another one that fell down in Portland. Tone, what's his name?
Tone Floater?
Tone Proper? Is that his
yeah,
name?
It's
Doesn't he have one of these as well? That
Yeah. But I don't really use that kind of thing, and everything works for me. It's been really my process has been good enough that people that come to me come back. And, oh, speaking of which, I want to pitch one more book while I'm here, and I think we were supposed to probably get out of here by 10 for something having to do. Are we reasonably okay, or you've got the...
I have a key.
You have the key, okay. It used to be that cleaning up the place, that if they had to stay after 10, but I think they cleaned up before we were here.
Oh, yeah, they're gone.
Yay, all right. I didn't want to push on the facilities at all. But Jake Perrine, who worked at Rick's place, and actually... I don't know if he told you this, but do you remember his Vamp rock opera? He had a rock opera 2-disc set. He came to me to master that. And we sat, he saw all of this, and then a little bit later he called and he said, hey, could you send me your settings for the C4? And I said, well, you know, if anything that I have is sort of a trade secret, that's it, but I'll give it to you. And that was fine. And I showed him some of these things. He went on and modified everything. So he's his own guy and very, very used to teach at Art Institute. And he's an Ableton Live master. He came and was mastering quite a lot at RFI. And he now has a book out this month as well called Sound Design, Mixing and Mastering with Ableton Live. And we do all of our work in Ableton. So looking at this made me very happy. This is the second book in a series that he put out. It's like, and actually, well, you're going to get your pitch just in a moment. This has been in the hot new recording books. This has been number one on Amazon. This has been number two. Once it was like this, and then it went back like that. But I bought it. That's probably what did it. And number three was Glenn Lerbecki's Mixing and Mastering with Pro Tools. Show it to the crowd, not to me. This is... So
I don't have Vanna White, so
yeah. Or Keisha. Right? So we have, and then Dave, of course, has Modern Recording Techniques version 7 is out, and that's on the charts all over the place. So congratulations. And we probably have other authors in the room. But I was talking to Rich, and that Glenn and I and Jake and whoever wants to come along should go on little audio book tours around the area and have signing sessions and the like and these kinds of things. So far, there's a ton that I did not go over. Okay, I'll just the thing that I think might be the most valuable in the book that is not what I was paid to do in a way is the real world mastering applications. My wife Julie has been collecting images for backgrounds, and she has 14,000 of them now. Over the last like 5 or 6 years, she's captured them into like 14 directories of 1,000 images apiece. We have them cycling. That's what these are. So it makes for a great distraction too, because I have my on the front here. This actually is my studio. That's my monitor. And I have a client monitor right over my shoulder that the guys on the couch can watch what I'm doing. And right next to it is my other computer that has these images going by. So it's nice to distract them. Gary has been a great client of mine for a long time. Gary Mueller, you've sat in that seat. Any comments?
It's entertaining.
There you go. And this really is an entertainment. So anyway, real world mastering applications and... which, like, capture and master your favorite records and tapes, music programs in high schools and colleges, and I talk about Shoreline Community College here and the Sonic Arts Club, where we did a CD here, and a lot of the students come back to me. Teen Center Studios, I've done a couple of Teen Center compilations, professional compilation albums, which is what we do in Burning Sky Records, and I did a Buffalo Springfield tribute for Not Lame. It was very interesting because I got 25, that was back in the days where you'd get a CD in for each song. And I've got a picture here that I can actually pull up of the songs as received, which was everywhere from absolutely clipped to being just minimal. And it's all 16-bit at the time because it was all CDs. And songs as returned. Actually, that was a that was a pretty great experience. Tribute albums in Burning Sky Records. Greatest Hits and Career Overview box sets. There are so many bands that try to make it, and so few that actually do, commercially at least. There is another type of success for bands, and that is to be influential. Many bands that never made it were the acts that your heroes went to see and were inspired by to play music or be rock stars. I've had the opportunity to gather the work of some of these artists, and the restoration and compilation is a challenge due to the often primitive recording conditions that bands just starting out employ. This presents another opportunity to listen for work. You don't look for work, you listen for work. Read interviews with your heroes or ask them about who their favorite artists were. There will be the standards, of course, but research the obscure bands. At some point, you may find a band that existed, but none of their work was ever released, like the Color Twigs stuff. Or that has an album on a major label, but also a large back catalog of demos. There's a band called Imperial Drag. I just finished a 4-disc set of a ton of demos that has been in process for like 5 or 6 years, and it looks like it's going to be released this summer, which is great. These are great tasks to take on primarily because musicians in forgotten bands may be grateful for your interest and be willing to work with you on a remastering project. Genealogy transcriptions, forensics. Forensics is one of the most lucrative areas of audio restoration and without exception the most traumatic. I've had a couple of well-paying jobs from lawyers seeking to clarify and decode 911 tapes. I found that this is not for me. One instance was of a young father just after a car wreck that killed his family. The other was a call from a payphone just prior to a murder. The karma is very heavy, and if you're willing to trade it for high cash income, you may want to explore this field. But it's like, no thank you. Companion CDs for books and instruction manuals, other record label work. The Seattle Fireworks audio, I go into sort of detail on how that came about and what to do with that. And your client and opportunity bases are infinite. Hopefully this chapter has shown the variety of opportunity available in the audio editing and mastering world. It is important to shift your attitude from looking for work to one of listening for how you can help others attain their goals and offer that service. Everywhere you go, there are people asking for help. Qualify the opportunities where you can make a difference and where your difference may earn compensation. Offer your services, but learn to fail fast and keep listening. Social networks are full of, we're just finishing up our album. That is an example of a flashing light for you to offer your assistance. The reason your clients and opportunities are infinite is that you can always find one more. And Animals and Cars was that kind of way, I think. I was noisy on Facebook, and all of a sudden it's like, hey, we've got this album coming up. Good. That was reeling it in. And then mastering as a business. This is very important to me. Mastering your music is like mastering your life. And mastering your life includes mastering your productivity and your actions. The message to present to the world and to your clients with your life performance is, I am very busy but highly efficient. Therefore, I am available and can solve your issue, whatever it may be, as exemplified in the following quote. If you want a piece of work well and thoroughly done, pick a busy man. The man of leisure postpones and procrastinates and is ever making preparations and getting things in shape. But the ability to focus on a thing and to do it is the talent of the man seemingly overwhelmed with work. That's Elbert Hubbard from The Philosophy of Elbert Hubbard in 1930, page 32, who is not L. Ron Hubbard at all. So I've always considered successful retirement as when your vocation, what you do for work, and avocation, what you do for fun, are aligned. If you retire tomorrow and you happily keep on doing what you did today, then you are essentially already retired. And if you're doing a job to pay for something that you love to do, how much less money would you be willing to take if you got to do what you love to do all the time? You know? And following your heart's desire, and that's sort of what the next world is all about. You know, begin where you are, learn to fail fast, generate and cultivate a brand. The business card, I've got my entire fold-out business card here. The business card binder, they're basically tips and tricks of how to deal with your business if you're a beginning, freshly self-employed person. Use QR codes or their current equivalent. Stay informed. Starting a business, business insurance, mileage and travel, keep a lab notebook, money, invoicing, the client environment, client contact and recruitment. And it says, be a shining light in your community. Join the local audio and production associations and societies. The Audio Engineering Society, top left QR code, and the Producers and Engineers Wing.
So there, the Queen's staff is still here.
Oh, we have to.
They want to come in here.
Okay, we're about to call it. Good, thank you so much. The Producers and Engineers Wing of the Recording Academy, bottom left QR code, provide great opportunities to interact with people that can use your help. If these societies don't exist in your area, contact them to set up a section or chapter in your town or travel to their events in other regions. This expands your potential client base beyond the local area. And thank you very much. We have to vacate the room.